your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Our chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. With me tonight is Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. Welcome to our program, Tony.
Hi, George. Nice to hear from you again. Thanks for inviting me on to speak.
Boy, I tell you, that there's a lot going on. That snap election is going to occur, what, next month in England?
That's right. We've got about 2 weeks to go now. And it's really interesting to see. I mean, you have to go back to the 1970s to find a opposition leader who is actually presenting a manifesto with widely different policies to the ruling Conservatives, or, you know, to any of the people who are standing, you know, as the resident government. And you have to go back to 1976 and the resignation, big inverted commas, of Prime Minister Harold Wilson. I'm not sure if you can remember him. You're old enough to remember him, George.
Yeah, I am. I remember them. Yep, yeah.
Yeah, Wilson was... He was a sort of kind of affable, gentle, pipe-smoking. He was an Oxford graduate. He was in philosophy and history, this kind of thing. And, yeah, he was the leader of the Labour Party in the 1970s in the battle there was going on between him backwards and forwards, ping-pong with Edward Heath, and in the 1960s too. But, yeah, in the snap election back in the 70s that Ted Heath held, he held a snap election in a similar way to we've got at the moment, thinking this is a good way because the Tories are doing well in the polls of kicking out Wilson and having a majority. Actually, what happened was the opposite, is that the country voted for Wilson. But then a few years later, we had in 1976, and if anyone has read the book Spycatcher, which is one of the most fascinating, riveting books you will ever read, that came out in the 1980s, written by Peter Wright. Now, Peter Wright was in charge of the sort of technical bugging side of MI5. And when he started to write his autobiography, in his memoirs, there were lots and lots of people very nervous in London. And they
tried
Mrs. Thatcher tried to ban it. Anyway, it was published in good old Australia. And lots and lots of copies kept flying over, coming by airmail, you know, over to Britain. And Britain was reading all this stuff, you know, so they couldn't really keep it quiet. But he made it absolutely clear in Spycatcher. And it's also in other books. I'm trying to remember the names of the titles, but one of them is by Robin Ramsey. There are various others that look at it's called the Wilson Plot, right? This is MI5. Plotting to get rid of the Prime Minister. So you've got the intelligence services having a Prime Minister in their sights, rather like they have with Trump at the moment over in the US, and plotting to get rid of the President or plotting to get rid of the Prime Minister. And that's exactly what they did with Wilson in 76, is he had had enough, basically, not being able to trust the military around him and the security services, having he and his cabinet colleagues homes burgled and bugged by the security services and them doing nothing about it. So at that point he left. So that's effectively where we are now, is the first contender to be Prime Minister, Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party, who is he's actually presenting a bunch of policies which are radically different. Now he's including things in those policies like renationalisation of the railways, right? Because anyone that knows Britain's railways knows that they're hopeless now, massively overcrowded, really overpriced. And everyone harkens back to the days back in the 1990s when British Rail was run as a nationalised industry. It used to work. You know, it was space for you to sit down, all this kind of thing. Similarly, the post office, you know, the Royal Mail, they're talking about renationalising that, which was only nationalised a few years ago, by the way, to some of George Osborne's mates, bought up the major shares in it and got a bargain as well. And they even did it so it was a share issue, which where only massive shareholders could buy shares, so that ordinary people wouldn't get any shares and weren't allowed to have any shares. So it was a whole massive stitch up with that. So and also they're talking about very, very tough renationalisation and of parts of the electricity industry and complete renationalisation of the water industry. So with all of our utilities, I think it's mostly because older people in Britain can remember when things used to work, and when you used to pay a bill, you knew you were paying just for the service, not to pay fat cat bosses, shareholders, etc. off, that you were actually paying what it cost to administer that utility, and not like three or four times over the odds. And we're in that crazy situation now in Britain where most of the profits made in Britain are made in the financial sector, not in the real economy. You know, so you've got the financial sector actually parasiting off of the real economy, making lots of money through, effectively like kind of gangster tactics, really. That is through monopolies, through jacking up the price and threatening their customers. And it's not a nice world. And that's why I think Jeremy Corbyn's presenting a very different year. Foreign policy too, George. He's expressed very clearly that if he's elected as Prime Minister, that will be the end of any arms sales to Saudi Arabia, any support for Saudi Arabia in the foreign policy, as well as, you know, sort of bringing in a more ethical general foreign policy. But he's said, the day I am elected Prime Minister will be the day there will be no more sales to Saudi Arabia, because they're a dictatorship, effectively, in a brutal regime that's bombing its neighbours with no accountability. So, you know, it's been quite interesting to see. And also on the other side with the Conservatives, very strange manifesto launched last week, George, where they're saying, oh, well, what we're going to do is we're going to take part of your house off of you if you get ill and you get made ill. The government will be putting you into a care home or something, but will also be taking your house as collateral, which means obviously if you get ill in later life, you can't pass your property down.
Oh my gosh, you can't. Yeah,
now this is something which is not going down well amongst the home owning Tory voters.
Boy, that's for sure. Under Thatcher, much of that privatization occurred. Is that true?
Yeah, it was in parallel with the Labour Party fighting against that in Britain with the Conservatives and Thatcher. Was at the same time as that Ronald Reagan was doing similar things. It was called monetarism. At the BBC, they were doing something very similar too in the 1980s. They got rid of the traditional people who were running the media, the BBC, and got this guy John Burt in, and he was actually a monetarist. You know, he was there to sort of make sure that the BBC hypnotized the population. You know, there's Michael Hudson, and his book Killing the Host talks about this, and I was just listening to an interview with, he's a brilliant economist,
right,
the other day, saying that what happens with a parasite is it injects into the host enzymes which mollify the host, so they don't realise that they're having their blood sucked. Yeah, and they don't realise what's going on, so the brain gets dulled and this kind of thing. And that's exactly what John Burt was doing with the BBC. As the Fowley silver was all being sold off, these various parts of Britain being sold off cheap to the mates of the Conservative Party and Victor Rothschild and the City, who were really running the show at the time. Well, Thatcher was just a puppet, really. So people didn't realise, because the BBC was hypnotising people, you know, was saying, oh, this is going to be great for the country, blah, 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 because through John Burt and his control of the BBC as Director General at the time, that's why people didn't quite realise what was going on. It's difficult to keep up with the economics jargon. But I'll tell you one thing. I've just had an interview last night with Professor Steve Keen. Professor Steve Keen is an economist at Kingston University, and he's written some great books. One is Debunking Economics, which is all just about what an absolute load of rubbish most of the financial journalists and academics talk about economics, and why so much of what they say is just complete and utter nonsense. And in fact, it's deliberate nonsense, and only the people who will spout this deliberate nonsense get employed in the media as financial journalists and in universities as financial professors. So he's quite a maverick, really. And his latest book is called Can We Stop the Next Financial Crisis? And I said to him at the beginning of the interview, can we? And he said, look, the short answer is no, we can't. And I think many of us realise that what we've done is we've just carried on as if nothing has happened with this financial crisis. And so we're building up this massive stock market bubble. We're building up a massive housing bubble. And we're living on funny money, this quantitative easing, which should be being spent on repaying off the paying off the national debt. So we don't have this massive national, what we've got in the UK is £2 trillion nearly now of national debt. What we start doing is spending into the economy so poor people can have money to spend to get the economy going. No good giving it to the rich because they tend to just save it. They don't spend it. We need the money spending power in order to get the economy going, George.
Right. Hey, I must congratulate you on your predictions about the Bilderberg, Tony Gosling. When did you predict it? What date? Do you remember exactly? It was January, maybe, of this year?
I think it was, it was around about the 12th, 15th of January.
Okay, and you hit, boy, you predicted a great, right on a nail on the head. Tell us about that prediction.
Well, what you have to do, really, is you have to use a little bit of educated guesswork and a little bit of hard graft. And there are five or six journalists of us here in Britain who follow this stuff, and we all kind of work together and contact each other, right, what have you done? And I was pretty disappointed with the US journalists and with the channels like the Alex Jones channel, who really got the resources to do this, should be doing this investigative journalism, because we dug up the block booking of the Chantilly Hotel. Now, it hasn't been in the US for a few years, so the obvious thing to do is around about the normal Bilderberg time, end of May, beginning of June, check that hotel out. And we checked it out, and it had been block booked from the Wednesday night right the way through till the Sunday. So it was pretty clear that might possibly, potentially be a Bilderberg meeting that had booked it out, especially since the hotel wouldn't say anything about the booking. So that's when we put out the initial information saying this looks like where it's going to be this year. And then literally this week, speaking to some of the other journalists, have you heard from the U.S.? Has anyone checked this out? Has anyone confirmed it?
Well, you know, the main person is Dan Dix out of Canada, that he'd been making some pronouncements, but that's about it.
Well, yeah, but the trouble is nobody had actually managed to get it confirmed. So
that's right, you did though.
What we did is we contacted one of the Fairfax County police stations and asked them to confirm it, and they did. So, yeah. You know, it didn't give names and things like that. It didn't say we're journalists. We just wanted to get some hard facts on is this or is this not the Bilderberg conference. So we finally got those. And I just think for everyone listening, it's one of those always someone else's job syndrome. What we're trying to do is sort of spread the load a bit by saying to everybody, look, if 2 months before the conference, say, you know, when we're talking about April or something, there's still no confirmation, everybody's got to get on the case. Let's pool our resources. Let's use a bit of force multiplication to chase these guys down. And so anyway, that's what we've managed to do this week. So people can think now much more clearly about whether to book tickets, you know, book hotels and all that sort of thing, air tickets to get to cover the conference.
Right. Are you going to come over okay or what, you think?
No, I'm staying. I'm covering it from here. Okay. So there'll be people linking in, probably you, George.
Yeah, we'd like for you to come in and do some work with us on that during the conference or that Saturday, I guess, or so.
I'll be looking through. Basically, what I'll be looking to do is fill media time slots over in Britain so that we can explain to the British public what's going on.
Good.
You know, I think that's the main job, I think, for me for this year, is to really, I mean, like last year it was interesting over in Dresden meeting everybody, but, you know, there's two things that need to be done here. It's all very well everyone collecting and gathering outside the conference talking about
sure.
it, but unless you're managing to get this info out to the public live and in real time, you know, it's there needs to be a bit of a kick up the backside, I think, for the mainstream press over here in Britain. Because a lot of the time, if no one else is covering it, then they will just think, oh, well, shrug their shoulders and say, well, what's Bilderberg? You know, they can't be bothered to look into it even.
Right.
So, you know, you and I know that this is one of the most important events of the year.
Yes,
when
it
comes
is.
To deciding our future. I mean, we're talking about people that control most of the money in the Western world. We're talking about people with very, very close links into the future of the media via the internet, that is to say social media. We're talking about media shopping. We're talking about Amazon. We're talking about LinkedIn, you know, social networks of all sorts, including Facebook, PayPal, money, online money. We're talking about Twitter. We're talking about Google, mainstream Google. That is to say all the kind of things that Google do. That is the search engine, which is the front end for the National Security Agency. Very good search engine it is, but don't think that they're not watching everything you do. And in fact, they will come on in real time and have a look at you from the National Security Agency if you're using Google and you're searching for something that they don't want you to search for or they want to keep an eye on. They will be in real time. They'll probably come into your webcam even and see who you are whilst you're doing a search. You know, if you're searching for something which is flagged up for them, they've got manual operators. That is people sitting at desks who, you know, if the algorithm comes out such that they think this is something we should be looking at, they will be peeping at you. Who's doing this? Right. Let's have a look at their profile. They're also doing data mining, massive data mining. People wonder why it is that, sometimes databases get robbed. Stolen, well, they all go into these massive data mine storage facilities, the sort of things that Peter Thiel gets very excited about with his Palantir technology, Gotham technology, and these kinds of companies, DeepMind at Google and Eric Schmidt have been doing, where the governments around the world can now start to have massive databases, profile databases on their entire population, and they can do kind of predictive stuff and play with them to say, well, you know, how can we satisfy the ordinary people? Really important thing, I think, the most important take-home over the last few years from Bilderberg has been the way that the financial people and the oil people have sort of almost not totally disappeared, but they're not quite so much in the driving seat as they were. The people running things now are the likes of Schmidt and Thiel. They are in charge. They're on the steering committee and have replaced people like David Rockefeller, who so sadly died I think it was just a couple of months ago now, wasn't it, at the age of 101. He was one of the main people, certainly at the beginning, the founding of the Bilderberg Conference. He's passed on, and he's handed on the curse to the likes of Thiel and Schmidt.
Right. You know, Mike Cernovich is saying or reporting here in the last day or two that Peter Thiel is not being able to get any of his people hired on with Trump.
Well, that's probably because Trump doesn't trust him, and Trump, I think, would be right not to trust him.
I think so.
Old Trump, there's been lots of criticism of him. Of course, there's bound to be. But I think he's doing everything he can to push back against the Israel lobby, which is really important.
Right.
You know, the Israel lobby is so powerful here. We've just seen this amazing story, which went 10 times around the world last weekend, I think. It was just at the beginning of the week, to do with the so-called exploding laptops story. You know, the exploding laptops.
Oh, yes, yes, uh-huh, yeah.
Well, that whole thing was cooked up by the Israelis. I don't actually think there's any truth to it at all. But anyway, it was handed as a piece of big inverted commas intelligence to the CIA, to the US, saying that ISIS are planning to put exploding laptops on planes. Well, of course, the big side effect of all that is going to be what? Well, it's going to be a big increase in money for the security companies, the private security companies that run airports and all that stuff. But it'll be massively inconvenient for people. It means that when you're on a plane, you can't work, you know,
right.
So you can watch one of their awful movies or play one of their silly games or watch the plane fly across the terrain or whatever whilst you're flying, but you can't actually work. Now, that's appalling, yeah?
Right, yes, it is.
How many tens of thousands or millions of hours of work is that stealing from our companies in the West? Anyway, so that suggestion came from the Israelis. I think it was complete nonsense. Anyway, so Donald Trump quite rightly shared it with the Russians, saying, well, this is what I'm being told, is that there's potential for ISIS to put exploding laptops. And this is then taken as a way to beat Donald Trump over the head.
Right.
How dare you share this intelligence? Well, the thing is that they didn't want to talk about the laptops. They were saying he has shared this intelligence. And the fact of the matter was that this laptop story was out, George, in March. So we're talking 2 months later. They've dredged up some old story, and they're trying to throw it at Trump. Well, Trump just says, well, I'll tell the Israelis anything I feel fit to tell them.
Right.
Sorry, the Russians, anything I feel fit to tell them.
Yeah.
So the Israelis are trying these little tricks. You know what they've also done? Just in the last couple of days, they've said, oh, it wasn't our intelligence. It was from Jordan. So that as their story starts to crumble, they then wriggle and writhe and say, oh, well, it wasn't us. It was the Jordanians. So it's pretty obvious that Trump is not dancing to Israel's tune anymore, and that's made a massive difference, because Hillary,
yeah,
of course, would have done
it
that.
It has. Now, that's where Alex had been spending a lot of his time lately, is defending Trump, see? And he's been under assault. There are indications that some ideas are to hold a new election. That's what some is being...
Well,
back.
That's right. They're talking, yeah, about, they're talking about impeachment here, the BBC, but well, we're talking about the Zionist BBC.
Well, there are three angles here that I see. One group is pushing for a new election. One is trying to use the 25th Amendment because of incapacity of some kind or psychological instability. And then the third thing would be an impeachment charge of some kind. See?
Yeah, well, they're trying to get him out of the way because he's not doing what the Israelis want. And I think everyone needs to know that. If this whole impeachment thing appears, that's... The only reason it's happening is because he's not doing what the Israelis want him to do. I mean, I feel really awful about it. I mean, you've got this whole business with Seth Rich. I don't know if you've been covering
it. Yeah, we've covered it too. Yeah, Seth Rich was murdered, yeah, and he was leaking to WikiLeaks.
The thing is, I think Assange has done a good job here because he won't name Seth Rich, right? He hasn't said he was the source of the Hillary emails. But it's pretty clear, reading between the lines, that you've got Seth Rich handing these emails, which were about fixing things so that Bernie Sanders would not get the nomination. That is, you know, basically total corruption within the DNC. He handed those emails to Craig Murray, realizing that there's a very great deal of importance and public interest in what he's doing. And Craig Murray, he's the former ambassador, Uzbekistan ambassador, then handed those over to Julian Assange.
That's
and
right.
The rest is history.
Yeah. Right.
But this is really, you know, this is at the heart of what is wrong with the democracy in the West, is that you've got a crazy situation where Clinton has stolen the nomination, and actually by stealing the nomination, she's handed the election to Trump. So, you know, that is to say, a Democrat gives... falls on her sword in a way. That's what's going on, isn't it? So she's just decided, right, I'm the Democratic nominee, but I'm not going to win, and I don't care whether I win or not. I want to be the nominee. She's just
Media here, though, they're not journalists anymore at all. They're just puppets for propaganda, you know.
Now you have to remember, George.
Yeah, they're just spewing forth propaganda, you know.
Yeah, the mainstream press, though, the way it works is you never see the people that run it. I don't know if you've ever seen this amazing series, Max Headroom, which was produced by Channel 4, I think, in the 1980s. I would suggest all your listeners drag it, find it somewhere. It's just it's a drama series about a journalist that works for Network 23, and this is a fictional thing. I think it's based in the U.S., and he finds quite regularly that his journalism leads back to his own boardroom at the top of Network 23. And you see several episodes where this journalist guy, he'll turn up at the board and he'll start trying to interview some guy who's a director of his own channel. And suddenly, of course, the camera gets switched off remotely, you know.
And golly.
It's a fantastic cyberpunk series, and I really recommend your listeners haven't seen that, that you dig out a few copies of that, because it's brilliant. It was one of the best drama series ever made. It was a real hiatus in the 1980s.
Have you covered any of this cyber attack that just occurred this last week? We have a bit.
But look, yeah. The big take home from that story is another aspect too. I mean, I just wanted to say one little tiny thing about Assange before we...
Oh, okay, go ahead.
...jump to that, because look at all of this stuff to do with him, there being no charges against him, no case against Assange. I mean, it's all becoming rather transparent, isn't it, that the girls over in Sweden, it seems, were just making this stuff up. I mean, the amazing thing to me about the coverage of this is you've seen hardly any mention of the names of the people who it looks like now have falsely accused him of rape. Now, this is really serious. You go to the police and accuse somebody of raping you, yet you have been saying what a nice person they are after the apparent rape, and right. saying cool it is to be with them, etc., which is what Anna Arden did. She was his press secretary for several days, apparently, after he sexually assaulted her. So she's saying that Assange sexually assaulted her, yeah, but I'm going to still carry on as his press secretary. And then once he disappears back off to the UK from Sweden, then she goes to the police and says, you know, that there's been a sexual assault.
Right.
And the other girl that he was with, I'm just trying to find her name. So that's right, Sophia Weilen, W-I-L-E-N. She's the one who actually accused him of rape a couple of days later.
Right.
But they were both boasting of the conquest of Julian Assange. Hey, man, you know, it's so cool to be with him and all this kind of thing. And right. yet, it doesn't make any sense. I think both of them are lying. There's also very strong evidence that Anna Arden was connected with the CIA, that she's been working for these anti-Castro groups and things like this in order to gain intelligence, you know, using her good looks to gain intelligence. So that's a whole other side to this, which hasn't been mentioned at all about Assange.
What about this thing about the UK having some charges because of bail jumping against Assange? What is that?
Well, it's just another excuse, isn't it? That somebody, somebody at the Home Office has said, look, what else have we got on him? You know,
right.
Look, he's the most important publisher in the world. He is the equivalent of someone like George Orwell as a writer, you know, was in the 1950s. Because he's a publisher rather than a writer. I mean, he's doing an incredible job in getting this stuff out to the public, in leaking some of the most damning human rights abuses anywhere in the world. I think if you remember that collateral murder video, that was one of the most incredible scenes, to see these Reuters journalists being machine gunned from a helicopter.
Right.
In front of our eyes. Brilliant journalism, the best journalism in the world. So no wonder the bad guys in the West are after him.
Sure, that's right. So, he exposed a lot of things that needed to be exposed, that's for sure.
Yeah, the ransomware, interesting story, isn't it? And also, did you know that one of the British government's most vulnerable...
Their health service got hammered, yeah.
No, even worse than that.
What?
Our Trident submarines...
Oh, my gosh.
They are. This is something I was reading on globalresearch.ca the other day. The Trident submarines have not got updated Windows versions on them, George.
hey, if somebody could invent something that would neutralize all radioactive bombs in the world, wouldn't that be good? Huh?
Well, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's an explanation as to whether they did that trial.
Yeah.
June last year, they fired off that missile, and it went sort of...
It went haywire. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Maybe it was the Russian hackers taking the mickey, eh?
Maybe it's one 12-year-old kid with a transmitter and some hacking. Who knows?
Also, just finally, I've got this. We've got this series on Sky One.
Okay.
Inside the Freemasons. Now, I don't know if you're interested in the Freemasons, but it's one of those series where I actually track down a former Mason, a former senior Knights Templar Mason,
right.
who's also a retired Army officer. And he's really damning of this series, George. It's great. If you go online, you can find the review he's done. So if you put the Inside the Freemasons Sky review up into YouTube, you'll find his reviews he's done. But he really just tears the series to pieces. He says, it looks to me as a Mason that this has been made by Masons as a recruitment film. It's been marketed as an investigative documentary, but it's nothing of the sort. And, you know, he's forensic in his pulling apart of the things that they don't say. For example, going through the various ways to be murdered as part of their initiation rites, which he explains, look, you know, this is what they're actually saying. And he also talks about the way that if you're not liked by the Masons, if you're removed from Freemasonry, the way that they can just literally make your work collapse, your business collapse, that they will actually start to attack you, people who used to be your friends. But the most important thing, I think, in a way that he explains is the way that when people get initiated into the first degree, they have no idea what they're getting into. And so you're taking a step in the dark, effectively. It's like as a child, maybe a 2 or 3 year old, just walking off the edge of a swimming pool into the deep end. Now, I've no idea where I'm going, but off I go. Right. And that's exactly the way he describes what Freemasonry is. So, interesting to see that the Freemasons feel it's necessary to put this kind of nonsense propaganda on, and we make sure that there's plenty of links to other places where you can get good information on Freemasonry, which, by the way, the oaths, many people say, are actually identical to the oaths that are sworn in other sorts of cults, religious cults, like witchcraft. So people need to know that, and Sky and Murdoch have done actually no examination of that at all.
Well, you know, Rupert Murdoch has come out in support of Trump. He's coming out, not only privately. Alex exposed that, added that just a day or two ago.
Well, it may be, but you see, the thing is, I wouldn't necessarily trust a single thing that Rupert Murdoch says. He may say he's a Trump supporter, but he may not be. I mean, you just don't know. It's like forked tongue with this guy.
Yeah.
And there's no way that somebody like that should have so much say and so much power as he does, particularly someone who's been... I mean, he's had his newspapers closed down here in Britain because of the links to organised crime and also crime links and Freemasonry, funnily enough, as well, within the police. So using criminal links, organised crime links, to get leaks from public services like the police. In other words, so I go to the police in a case and I've got some evidence for the police, I might come out and find that evidence on the front page of the News of the World the next day because of the crooked police and the crooked News of the World journalists are doing this. I mean, I, as a journalist, if I was handed that sort of private information, unless it was about a very rich, powerful person that it may be that there was a public interest in publishing it, there's no way I'd do it. So Murdoch's papers are used to scapegoat people, really, and to throw mud at people. And we need to have a bit more responsible journalism, because we started off talking about this, didn't we? It's not the journalists that run these organisations. It's the shareholders. It's the super rich, like Murdoch. And they own the transmitters, they own the printing presses, George. A journalist is nothing. Without a transmitter, without a blog or an outlet of some sort for the mass media, and without a way of getting the stuff out in the mass media, it's very difficult. And that's what many of us are up against now, is we're trying to tell the truth. But the trouble is, we're speaking truth to power, and all power wants to do is pump out propaganda.
Now, let me ask you another question, one last closing question about the Bilderberg. We haven't seen them put out any information lately. Are they being very secretive this year?
Well, they're always secretive. I think it's probably... one thing they probably wouldn't want people to know is that they do have meetings of the steering committee in between the main conferences.
Yes.
We've had a couple of years over the last 20 years or so, people have just kind of stumbled across these meetings.
Right.
One in Italy, I remember, and said, look, this is what they're up to. But that does happen. The meeting has just been confirmed, I understand, on the Bilderberg Meetings official website, as in Chantilly as well. Now we've outed it. They've followed suit. The other thing to mention is, I think, you know, to look at Bilderberg, you have to look at the links between them and Freemasonry. You've got Andrew Palmer,
who's the private secretary of the Duke of Kent, who's the Grand Master of the United Grand Lodge in London, one of the biggest, you know, Masonic fraternities in the world and one of the originators of Freemasonry. Andrew Palmer was the organizer of one of the last conferences that took place in Britain. He was the Bilderberg Conference organizer, and he says he's very, very closely tied in to Freemasonry. Also, one of the founders, Joseph Rettinger, Polish MI6 agent, who was involved in the death of General Sikorsky at the end of World War II, the Polish general, you know, very suspicious circumstances there. Rettinger also was a Mason. Some of the Polish researchers had dug that up. So you've got Mason footprints, fingerprints all over Bilderberg. And I think that's really the way the Western world works, is you've got a shadow government in each country, in each province, as they would call it. And we saw that, didn't we? Propaganda due in Italy. We saw the revelations about that in the 1980s with this secret committee in Italy effectively running the entire country from behind the scenes. That was exposed for a short period of time. I think we've got that in most countries in the West. We've got these secret Masonic committees. And I was fascinated to see, going back through John Robison's book from the late 1700s about the Illuminati, that they word that they were using for their Illuminati organizing committees was the propaganda committees.
And so, yeah, the propaganda committee.
They actually were. Yeah. That was back in the 18th century, George, and then there we see it rearing its ugly head again in the 1980s in Italy with Propaganda Due. I wonder what Propaganda Uno is and where that is.
But, yeah, you know, what is it? man, I'll tell you. Boy,
who knows, maybe that's the Bilderbergers. I don't know. I mean, you know.
Well, what they're going to do, though, they will decide Trump's fate at the end of this meeting, this coming up in June. Don't you think?
Also, another big thing in their sights will, that they can't necessarily decide it. They will be looking at tactics to get rid of him.
Yeah.
I don't think they'll, unless they may even invite him and try and get him on board, George. This is one of the things.
Well, you know, he's signing up a $100 billion contract with the Saudis. That helps their munitions.
Well, you know, this is one of the purposes of these conferences. Yeah. Try and get people on board the program. There is a program. Come on, Trump, you know, come and see all these kings and queens and big bankers.
Right.
What do you mean you're thinking something else? We know what's going on. Get on board the program. Yeah. And that's the way they coerce people at the Bilderberg conferences.
Right, exactly. Boy, that's good, Tony. You've been on top of this for years now and appreciate all your work on that.
Anyway, so I think the other things in the spotlight will quite clearly be Iran. What are they going to do about Syria? They'll be on the agenda, but then also increasingly it's internet regulation, this kind of thing. How now we've got Google, we've got Peter Thiel, Facebook, etc., becoming very dominant. How do they retain their dominance, and how do they start cutting out the competition, the ordinary bloggers, the smaller networks, social networks, that if they can't buy them out,
Theresa May PDF file up on my site now.
They dominate the internet, that's quite clear. They want a
manifesto or something. She's got
She is definitely, as it looks like they will in a couple of weeks' time, just after the Bilderberg conference is our general election. It looks pretty sinister, really, because they are getting increasingly authoritarian, and they're quite, you know, they actually seem to be saying it openly, you know, this is the way we're going. You know, we think it's important that we've got to become more authoritarian. And that's no good at all. We that's not what we need. What we really need is we need some common sense, Steve Keen-like, you know, debunking economics common sense to give people money to start spending and get our economies going again, get rid of the national debt. Very easy thing to do, according to Steve. And that's the way to go. We don't need to go down this securocrat road. And that all that does is that feathers the lines the pockets of the super rich and the arms dealers, the military industrial complex. And it seems to me they're pretty much coercing most of the press to do and say what they want. There were always little gaps here and there, but it, you know, nowadays it's pretty much, I think, as I said last time, the Schwerpunkt of the attack the spearhead of the attack is the media, and we really need to make sure that there is an alternative out there for people to listen to if they want to. We can't reach that mainstream media, George, people like you and I. We can't reach the millions that they can, but what we can do is make sure that there is a critique out there. Once people get to fed up with seeing lies day after day, throwing things at the television, screaming at the radio, that there's a bit of common sense out there that they can listen to and latch onto.
Exactly. Really good points all the way up and down the way, Tony. Well, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. Any closing comments? Oh, give us your website and stuff like that, Tony.
That's right. Well, if you can find my YouTube channels, Peter Berenius, and that's the mostly the analytical stuff. The more newsy stuff is on Public Inquiry, and you can find all these links at bilderberg.org at the top of the page there. But the show page, if you want to have a listen to the podcasts, etc., is it just means download an MP3. You can listen to it in your car, wherever you want to, on your iPod or whatever you fancy. That's at thisweek.org.uk, and there's loads of links as well to the stories that we've been covering, including this stuff to do with Seth Rich. It's unbelievable, really, that this is not a major news story. It must be. It should be. I think we've got to keep banging on about this on and on. It's not on to murder people who are involved in such a central position in making sure that our democratic political parties are able to function. I mean, you know, it's just simply not on that the mainstream media should then just start denigrating anybody that says it might be murder. It means that the truth doesn't even get its boots on when you've got that kind of corruption in the media, that they can't see a murder that's staring them in the face.
Right. Well, thank you, Tony. And we do have those click-offs up there right now on our site. We want to thank you for this evening and for all your time.
Thanks, George, and thanks for all the work you're doing, too.
Okay, cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
Thank you, Tony. That was really fine reporting. And he could only be with us about 35 minutes or so. He's pretty busy over there in Bristol, England. But anyway, just wanted to elaborate and add a few details to this upcoming Bilderberg Group meeting. Tony predicted in January this year that it would be held at the Westfields Marriott Hotel in Chantilly, Virginia, on June 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of this year. So we put that up on our site and went with Tony's prediction, and it proved to be right. So they verified that, as I understand Tony was saying on the program just a few minutes ago, that they have verified as to for sure the main Bilderberg official site has confirmed that that's where the 2017 Bilderberg group meeting will be held, at the Westfields Hotel, Marriott Hotel in Chantilly, Virginia. Now, where once this started, just to give you a little background for some of those that never heard much about the Bilderberg Group, it's one of the most powerful groups in the world, if not the most powerful group that holds meetings. There's a lot of other groups that meet secretly that you never even hear of also. But this is announced every year. It has kings and queens and heads of state. And my gosh, it's got finance ministers and some of the biggest bankers in the world meet there, see. And they plan out some strategy and tactics for the coming year. Now, they'll meet at the Westfields, and they'll have the top security that it's unbelievable, the security that they bring in with them. So you can't get close to the meeting. It's held in secret. There's none of the members, the attendees that are there. They're sworn to secrecy, and they're not supposed to make any comments, even though sometimes they'll go out running. I think John Petraeus did this over in Germany, Dresden, recently, last year. And there were some reporters that followed him and got some, comments from him. They're very secretive. They're very powerful. Peter Theis, who actually backed President Trump during the election, and he's a high-tech man out of PayPal originally. He sold that off. Now he's into Palantir, which is a data mining operation that he got financing from the CIA originally. So he'll be there. He's on the steering committee. We don't have all the list yet, but we'll put those up as soon as we get those. But there's a Mike Cernovich is saying out of his website on YouTube that Peter Theis's people are not being hired by the Trump administration. But we have, there's some controversy. This second hour, I'm going to be playing some clips of Mike Cernovich and making some commentary about what he thinks is happening on the hiring basis of the classification C jobs that are currently being cut. So he's saying that pro-Trump people are being cut from the roster and going putting sending them home. So that, but you'll hear that his commentary during the hour two. But getting back to the Bilderberg meeting, the first was held in 1954 in the Netherlands at the Bilderberg Hotel. And so that's where it gets its name. One of the founding, C.D. Jackson, who was a CIA agent and also worked in the White House for Eisenhower, was one of the organizing members of that first meeting in 1954. He'd also worked for Time Look magazine before the war, and he was a psychological warfare officer during World War II, and then he got out, and then he went to work for Eisenhower in the White House on the international, advising him on international situations and events and relations. So anyway, he was very important. He also got rid of Joe McCarthy. There's evidence there in his own writings, which are archived also, C.D. Jackson's writings. But anyway, the Bilderberg since that time has become very, very powerful in its influence. And there are movers and shakers there at the top of the eating chains, you could say. And so David Rockefeller, those kind of people. The people that will be there will be Eric Schmidt of Google and Peter Thies. He has this Palantir now, and he's got investments with Joshua Kushner and Jared Kushner. They're all involved together. And that's where Jared Kushner is a question mark in my own mind. Having him in the White House then is a straight conduit to Peter Thies through his brother. So and Peter Thies is Bilderberg steering committee. So what do we have? We have infiltration of Trump's White House already through his son-in-law, you know. So don't support that, those kind of connections. And I think Jared Kushner was a bad choice to be in the White House for President Trump. There seems to be some other issues that are coming up that the Bilderberg Group, I think, will concentrate on these particular issues. And we'll put the list out if and when they do issue a list. They'll usually come up with about 8 or 10 issues that they'll present to the public through their press secretary. But they'll be debating what to do with Trump, see. They might, think about inviting him there if he's back. He'll be back in the States. Right now, he's still in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and he'll be there for 2 days, today and tomorrow, and then he'll fly out of there, okay? And his next stop will be in Israel, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and Bethlehem. Out for 2 days on the May the 22nd and 23rd, and then he'll fly out of there to Rome, and with the Vatican, with the Pope Francis, and then after that he'll go to Brussels, Belgium, and then after that down to Italy for his final ninth day. You could say he's going to be away about 9 days from the United States, so it's quite a trip. So far, he's signed over $100 billion worth of arms agreements with the Saudis. And so that's just a big chunk of money for the munition manufacturers. I'm sure that makes them happy. The attack on Trump is continuing. So we don't know how that will work out in the end. Getting back to the Bilderberg Group. So they'll determine what to do with Trump. The Syrian question is a major importance to them. And they are on the side of getting rid of Assad. And they have done everything they can. But it looks like with the Russians in there now and the Turks changing their tune a little bit, because of their situation and change of not leadership, but there was a military coup, an unsuccessful one against Erdogan. And he's beginning to view the Syrian question a little differently. So it looks like that they've just recently established these 4 safe zones throughout the country. There is a tendency for the military to strike back against Syrian forces, which they did just recently on against some kind of a convoy that they felt was intruding in on one of their safe areas. See, so we still have these problems like that out there that exist. And Trump, I know originally on the campaign trail, said he'd leave it up to Assad and them to establish their own peace. And now the Russians came in there and have done, you know, supported Assad. But also they're working together now. We have a hard line out of our UN representative there, and she continued to hammer very hard against the Russians and so forth. Now, the Bilderberg Group, I was over in Copenhagen in 2014. I held a symposium there, but sort of got sabotaged a little bit. But anyway, we did hold a symposium there. We went down and we did a protest there outside the hotel in downtown Copenhagen on the last day and so forth. So we got a good taste of what the Bilderberg is about and what they're... We've been following this for a number of years. When Jim Tucker was alive, we got reports from him one year when he was in Istanbul, I believe it was there. I got a live report from Jim Tucker from Istanbul on my program. So we've been after this and been following this for a number of years. And they are very, very powerful. They're very secretive. They do ruthless things to people. And we believe that they chose Obama over Hillary a number of years ago at this same hotel in Chantilly, Virginia. So they're kingmakers, see. They can put people into presidential, you know, positions, or they can take them out. And right now it appears that they are against Trump. But that could change after this meeting. We're going to watch this meeting carefully. There are three, you could say, attacks, it looks like, that have been formulated and that are ongoing against Trump. And one would be the idea of a new election. All this is centered around some Russian interference, see. But one attack would be centered around a new election. I think the Atlantic magazine is coming up, has a recent article on that. The second one would be some kind of an angle using the 25th Amendment because he's become incapacitated or psychologically unstable or something like that. And then the third one would be lodging some kind of an impeachment charge against him that they think would be voted on by the House. The House has to vote impeachment charges, but that's a simple majority. Then the impeachment goes to the Senate, but they have to convict with a two-thirds vote in the Senate, which is very difficult normally to receive. In this situation, because the insiders, okay, that control both parties didn't want Trump in there. So this is one of the few situations, and it's very unique in American history, where the real people, the real upper-level people that control both parties don't want Trump. So they could bring great pressure to bear, especially in the Senate and the House, to get the majority vote to bring the impeachment, but especially to get the two-thirds vote in the Senate for conviction of the impeachment charges. So it's possible, only in this case, in this historical point in time, you could say, that the movers and shakers, the people that really control the politics and the big money in this country, might be able to affect a two-thirds vote for conviction in the Senate against Trump. That the charges will be trumped up. They're not going to be legitimate. As far as the population in general that voted for Trump, and I was a supporter of Trump, and I still am a supporter of Trump. We voted for him because of, on the campaign trail, he was espousing certain very, very idealistic but very good goals. I think some of it came from Bannon and other speechwriters and so forth, and which we fully welcomed as a change, a fresh wind, a fresh breeze. See, going into the White House, he had to try to transition from a corporate mindset to this new thing called the Office of the Presidency, which is an entirely different kind of mindset in our politics, in our country. So it's not exactly a command position. It could be and is, but it is within the executive branch. But he's got the judiciary and the legislative branch to deal with. And one's elected and one's appointed. So he can't control the government like he could Trump Industries or Trump, you know, Incorporated with his hotel chain, see. So it's an entirely different experience for him of management, see. And he is learning and so forth. There are periods of time where he doesn't appear to be a very awake, see. Now we worry about his mindset sometimes. And he has this tendency to hit back, and that ego thing is still ruinous for him. He needs to try to control that ego. If he could try to just begin to see that that is a problem, and begin to try to control it and hold himself from hitting back too quickly, or thinking about things, contemplating a little bit more before he acts, or seeking some of these people in Washington have been there 35, 45 years with experience. He could draw upon good people. And I'm not saying the neocons and all that gang up there at the CFR and all that. I'm talking about people that are very, very well thought of. Pat Buchanan would be one. Roger Stone would be another one, and other people. There's Jonathan Ewald that I've gotten to listen to over the years. He has a very level-headed mind. He practices law in administrative law in Washington, D.C. And I think Ewald has some very, very good, well-grounded, commonsensical things to say. But he needs to seek out people like that have their feet on the ground. He does consult with Roger Stone. He's known him, been friends for 40 years, so I'm sure that there's some advice that's ongoing from Roger Stone. But he needs to get other people to get some kind of an input here that will keep him, restrain him a little bit from acting too rashly, see. And they say, hey, you know, Donald Trump, just a second, you know. Let's be careful here, you know. Let's be more cautious, see. And I just don't think there's any one person there that I can see. Maybe Melania might be a very that kind of a factor and so forth. But that ego it has been ruinous for President Trump. And I just hope and pray that he can come to grips with that and begin to see that has been very detrimental to him over the years. Now, in his own industry, in his own corporation, that's not going to interfere that much. But in this new position as President of the United States, he's got to develop diplomatic graces and things like that. And I think he has that. You see that in Riyadh yesterday and today. He's meeting there and getting along fine. They have rolled out the red carpet. My gosh, it must have been a mile long, that red carpet. And they were sweeping it and cleaning it as they went, you know. So they did roll out the red carpet for him. He's making big business deals for the munition manufacturers. So that should make them happy. So there are things that he's on this trip that he's trying to accomplish, see, that could cement his presidency for the future. And of course they pressured him, see, to react in the way that he's beginning to react. So they surrounded him. What they did was they intercepted his communications. They started profiling him, like the NSA and the CIA can do. Once they got his personality profile, then they knew what buttons to push. He's vulnerable in many ways because of his ego state. And then they just started using him and controlling him in ways that he never thought possible. But anyway, that's what I see. And we want to thank everyone out there in our listening audience for the support that you've given us over the years. And I get calls all the time from people and email and so forth, you know, that thank us for what we're doing. And Charlotte Littlefield and I have been on the air for well over 10 years now. And so we're not going to just give up on America. And we're not just going to fold our tent and leave. See, we're going to be here and try to get through this thing. And this attack on Trump is a very dangerous attack. And it has a propaganda in it that is very, very dangerous. And it's full of lies at times. See, and so we've got to be careful. The deep state is out there. They're totally against him. But again, I want to thank everyone for listening to us. And we are live here on 89.1 every Saturday night, 7 to 9. Thank you very much for listening, and God bless everyone out there. Good night.